I received three emails from individuals and groups of students, and I will just go through these emails and through the questions that people specified in their emails. So here's an email from Francisca, and she had three questions. By the way, I am Professor Zubanov, not Mr. Professor, PhD. That's ridiculous. Now, lecture 3, page 12. How did you come to the result that the total surplus of the partnership is equal to this expression? So this is lecture 3 about incentives, and at that stage of lecture 3, we were talking about the welfare improvements that comes with partnership. And in on slide 12, I think, of lecture 3, we had this result. So just to remind you, there are two people, A and B. They used to have their own income, IA and IB. And then, you know, they were both risk averse with risk aversion coefficients small r a and small r b. Then somebody had a great idea, let's put our assets together and form a partnership. Now we will distribute the total proceeds from our partnership so that person A will get a share of alpha of the total proceeds, and person B will get the share of one minus alpha of the total proceeds. We solved the optimization problem with respect to alpha, and we found that the shares in which the total proceeds from the partnership had to be should optimally be distributed in order to maximize the total welfare from partnership are such that person A gets the share alpha of the total proceeds from the partnership, and person B will get the remainder, 1 minus alpha, of the total proceeds from the partnership. Now, Francisca's question was, how did you come to the result that the total welfare from the partnership, the sum of the utilities of person A and person B, is equal to this expression? This is a purely mathematical derivational question. It's fairly easy. So let us write down the certainty equivalent of the payoff of person A. Person A gets share of alpha of the total proceeds from the partnership, so that's what this term is doing here. Now, person A is risk averse, so his utility is expected utility from the income minus the costs of bearing risk from the partnership, and the costs of bearing the risk from the partnership are this term, so it's alpha squared minus half the risk aversion coefficient of person A times the variance of the total income from the partnership. Now, what does alpha squared do here? It used to be here because the person A gets alpha of the total proceeds, but then when if you want to take a constant out of the variance sign, you have to square it. That's why it's alpha squared here. So the certainty equivalent of the utility of partner A in the partnership is alpha times the total income expected minus alpha squared times person A's risk aversion coefficient times the total variance of the partnership's proceeds. Analogously, we can write it down for person B. Person B gets 1 minus alpha of the total proceeds, and because person B is also risk averse, you have this term, which measures person B's costs of bearing risk. Now let us just recall what optimal alpha. Let us recall what optimal alpha is, and let us substitute the alpha and 1 minus alpha throughout the expressions of the certainty equivalent for person A and person B. So we calculate the total we, where are we? Yeah, here. So the total surplus from the partnership is this, is the payoff for person A, payoff for person B, which is equal to the, unsurprisingly, to the expected income from the partnership. The most interesting part is the total, is the total costs of bearing risk. These are the total costs of bearing risk. It's the variance of the income from the partnership times half times this component. Now, if you substitute the optimal alpha and 1 minus alpha into this expression, then after some rather elementary calculations, which are given here, so just open the brackets, do the substitution, and then replace risk aversion coefficients with risk tolerance coefficients, which are just the reciprocals of the risk aversion coefficients, you will get the desired result. So you will get this 1 over RA plus RB. So is Francisco here?
Yes.
Does it answer your question?
Yes.
Good. Let's move on. Now, Francisco's next question is a question about Lecture 7. Lecture 7 was about recognition. Okay, so Lecture 7 was about recognition. So, how did you come to the probability, to this formula for the probability of fulfilling the norm, given that you didn't receive recognition? So, it's the simple Bayesian formula, the probability of fulfilling the norm, given that you didn't receive recognition, so we are talking about the non-recipients here, is equal to the probability of not receiving recognition when you do fulfill the norm, times the probability, your subjective belief that you do fulfill the norm, which is P by the design of the question, divided by the probability that you don't receive recognition. And the probability that you don't receive recognition is by definition 1 minus rho. Why is it 1 minus rho? Because the share rho of the group, the best rho, receive recognition, therefore 1 minus rho will not receive recognition. What's the probability, assuming the uniform distribution of performance within the group, which is the assumption we have maintained throughout, what is the probability that you will not receive the norm? Well, it's 1 minus the probability of receiving the norm. So, that's it. The most interesting term in this expression is this. What is the probability that you don't fulfill the norm what is the probability that you don't receive recognition given that you have fulfilled the norm? Well, that's how it's calculated. The geometry, here is a very simple geometric illustration. We assume that everything is uniform here. 0, 1, here is the norm, eta. You want to be here. So if your performance is here, then you fulfill the norm. The recognition is given to rho, the share rho of the group, and by this and in this case rho is less than eta. Now, what is your probability of what is your probability that you do not receive the recognition even though you fulfill the norm? Well, the probability that, assuming the uniform distribution, the probability that you do fulfill the norm is eta. Now, if you didn't receive recognition, you're somewhere here, somewhere in this area. Now, the area of this bit divided by the total is just eta minus rho divided by eta. So here is then the probability of... here is the probability of not receiving recognition given that you fulfill the norm. Now, substituting this result back in our Bayesian expression gives the result in the lectures. Does it make sense? Yes? No? What's your further question?
Yes. Could you explain again why you divide it by eta?
Because we condition on fulfilling the norm. It's conditional on fulfilling the norm, so you have to divide by the probability that you fulfill the norm. Mm-hmm. So now, I remember there was another question about this topic. The other question was from Caroline. Yeah. So your question was lecture 7, practice questions 2 and 3. So practice question 2 was to do the same for the recipients of recognition. Here is the same thing for the recipients of recognition. Now for the recipients of recognition, if recognition is... Well, if recognition is scarce in the sense that rho is less than eta, it's not very interesting, because if rho is less than eta and you still receive recognition, then the probability that you fulfill the norm is 1. Now, the more interesting case for the recipients of recognition is the case when recognition is abundant. So when recognition is abundant, it means that, you know, the share rho of the people who receive recognition is actually larger than the share of people, eta, who fulfill the norm. So given that you're a recipient of recognition, you have received recognition, what is the probability that you actually fulfill the norm? It's not 1, it's less than 1. Why is it less than 1? Because you can be here as a recipient of recognition. You can be here, and here, the people here do not fulfill the norm, and yet they do receive recognition. Now, what is the probability that you do... What is the probability that you do not fulfill the norm? What is the probability that you do not fulfill the norm and yet you receive recognition? The probability that you don't fulfill the norm and yet receive recognition is rho minus eta divided by rho. Okay? So doing the same calculations will give you the result that Caroline was asking about. Now practice question three: what is the optimal rho given eta? Should you recognize scarcely or should you recognize abundantly? The answer to this question depends on whose performance response you want to elicit the most. Do you want to elicit the performance response? Do you want to enhance the performance response of the recipients or non-recipients of recognition? Now, we know that when it comes to fulfilling the norm, recipients will respond negatively to recognition, so we don't want to play with the recipients. Let's look at the non-recipients and let's look at the interesting case when recognition is scarce. So why is it so interesting? Because when rho is less than eta, recognition is more scarce. When rho is less than eta, there could still be a probability that you actually fulfill the norm, even though you didn't get the recognition. So if you subtract the updated probability that you fulfill the norm, even though you didn't get the recognition, and this probability is, what is it? It's eta minus rho times p divided by 1 minus rho here, right? So if you subtract it from p, then the change in your beliefs after recognition is given by this expression. So this is the change in your belief that you fulfill the norm as a non-recipient of recognition. That's this expression. You can derive it. It's very, very easy. Now, you want to maximize this updated belief. You want to maximize this because, you know, the more strongly you revise your beliefs, the more strongly your performance will respond to the fact of not receiving recognition. So we want to maximize this guy with respect to rho. Eta is given. You want to maximize it with respect to rho. We take the first order condition. That's where mildly interesting things start, because if you take the first order condition, you'll see that the derivative of this expression with respect to rho is uniformly positive. So what it means is you can whack rho up to as much as you can, right? It's never going to be equal to zero, so you're hitting the corner solution. Now, what is this corner solution? It's not zero. Because at zero, a rho is the minimum possible you can send, you can set. And you here, because the first derivative is positive, you want to set rho at the maximum possible level. Now, what is the maximum possible level at which you can set rho? What is the maximum possible level at which you can set rho? Yeah? 100% no, eta. Because remember, here we're dealing with the case of recognition being scarce. Recognition being scarce. All right. So, if you want to maximize this expression is defined for the case of rho less than eta. So here's your constraint. So you set rho equal to eta, and this will maximize the performance response of the non-recipients of recognition to not receiving recognition. So here is a little trick about corner solution that you have to be aware of. Now let's move back to Francisca's questions. Her last question is about lecture 8. What is lecture 8? I think it's teams, right? And Francisca's question is, how is the total output of 1 and of alpha divided by this calculated? I'm not answering this question, I'm sorry, because it's too easy. You have the individual, Francisca, are you with me? So you have the individual effort, you substitute this effort into the expression for the total effort, and that will give you the total effort. Unless I misunderstood your question. No? So the case of alpha being greater than 1, I think, is the most interesting case, right? So you have the you take the individual efforts. Individual efforts are the same for everybody, right? So the expression within the brackets is going to be n times individual effort, and then you raise this thing into the power of alpha, and you will get the total effort or total output. Is this now a little bit clearer? Okay, so I didn't want to write it down because it's just a matter of substitution. It's not even a matter of derivation. Okay, so these are all the questions from Francisca. Do you have any further questions? Very good. So let's move on to the questions of other students. The question from Nico and Daniel. Are you guys here? Okay, hi. So you asked two questions, and one question I quite liked. The other question was okay, but I think I'll just give an answer to it without derivations. The question I like from you was this career concerns question. So career concerns is, of course, a wonderful model that explains a lot of what we observe in the labor market. That's why we study it in this course. I allowed myself to be creative about answering your question. Your original question was career concerns in the derivation of AT, the first order condition for the effort at each period T. How do you get the exponent S minus T plus 1 for beta in the pattern? Okay, let me open the slide with career concerns that you mentioned. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the maximization problem, the utility maximization problem with respect to effort that a career concerned agent chooses to exert at each period of time t. After some simple manipulations, you arrive at this function. And you want to differentiate it. You want to differentiate it with every AT. So before answering Nico and Daniel's original question, I would like to allow myself the opportunity to explain once again how you arrive at this first order condition. So it's basically to go through with you the derivations. The first order conditions look like this. So the first order condition with respect to A1 is this, with respect to A2 is this, etc., etc. Now, how do we derive the first order conditions with respect to each of these guys? Now, let me show you. So, can we? Oh, I'm sorry to be such a pain in the neck for our very helpful technical support. Oh, right. So, okay, I guess I just have to switch it off and turn it back on again. Yeah, right. Okay. So, now. So, this is basically your maximization problem. Here, I ignored the first term that you saw on the slides because it doesn't contain the A's, so it will not feature in the derivations. These are this is the second term, which I denote as A in what follows. And this is the third term, which I denote as B. So B is very easy. If you differentiate it with respect to AT, the only thing that contains AT is this term. So it's always going to be the marginal cost with respect to the effort level at every given period. So that's not very interesting, right? What is interesting is this guy, the term A. Now, let us visualize it. Let us see what it's made of, right? So, let us calculate the term A for different values of t. Because it's a bit boring, I chose to calculate it for t equal 1, for t equal 2, for t equal 3, and for t equal big T, the end of the period. Now, when t is equal to 1, small t is equal to 1, how does this term A look like? It doesn't look like much, because when t is equal to 1, here you have a function, here you have the summation which starts with 1 and ends with 0. Now, if you read on Wikipedia about the rules for calculating sums, you will quickly realize that if the beginning of the count is less than the end of the count, the sum is equal to 0. So when small t is equal to 1, there is no term A, forget about it. When small t is equal to 2, right? When small t is equal to 2, let's just calculate. So t equals 2 here, which means that that beta is now raised into a power of 2 minus 1. So now we have beta to the power of 1 times this ratio between h of epsilon, which is the precision of the performance noise or of the performance signal, divided by h0, which is the precision of the ability signal, times 2 minus 1, the precision of the performance once again, right? So when small t is equal to 1, beta to the power of t minus 1 becomes just beta, and this term becomes just the ratio of the noise to performance to the total noise of the output signal. Okay, so now what happens here in this sum? When t is equal to 2, you have the summation from 1 till 1. Okay, so basically when t is equal to 2, this sum becomes just this term, just this single term, eta plus a1, which is your effort level in period 1, plus epsilon 1, which is the noise to performance in period 1, minus a star 1, which is the equilibrium level of effort in period 1. So that's how term A looks like when looks like in the second period of the worker's employment. It's just beta times this ratio times this lonely guy which contains only A1 and nothing else. Okay? Make sense? Now, let us do the same when t is equal to 3. When t is equal to 3, it's a little bit more complicated, but not much more complicated. It's really just a little bit. So, small t equals 3, we have beta to the power of 3 minus 1, which is 2. Okay? When t equals 3, you have this ratio h epsilon divided by h0 plus 2 times h epsilon, right? When t is equal to 3, this sum, when t is equal to 3, this sum contains how many components? How many components? 2. Because it's a summation from s equal 1 to s equal 2. So it's 1 and 2. So this sum will be eta plus a1 plus epsilon 1 minus a star 1 plus eta plus a2 plus epsilon 2 minus a star 2, right? So when small t equals to 3 equals 3, this problematic term becomes something like this. This problematic term becomes something like this. Oh, I didn't know this. That's cool, huh? Wow. Okay. So this is how this term, problematic term A, looks like when small t equals 3. Let's make it dead certain that everybody understands how things look like, and calculate it for small t equal to the end of the period. So what happens when small t equals to big T? Well, beta to the power of big T minus 1 divided by this ratio, which has now big T minus 1 here. Nothing, it's not very interesting. What is interesting is here. Here you have a sum which contains how many components? Big T minus 1. Okay? Let's write it out extensively so that everyone understands. Now, writing it out extensively is eta plus a1 plus epsilon 1 minus a1 star. This is for the first period. Plus eta plus a2 plus epsilon 2 minus a2 star. This is for the second period. Plus eta plus a3 plus epsilon 3 minus a star 3. This is for the third period. You get the idea, right? Plus eta plus a big T minus 1 plus this other business with the subscript big T minus 1. Okay? Now, don't forget that the original term is the sum of these guys. So the original term is the sum of this plus this plus this plus etc. plus this. Okay? So really the maximization problem contains a hell of a lot of A1s, a little bit less of A2s, a little bit less of A3s, etc. Okay? And no ATs, by the way. That's why the optimal effort in the terminal period is strictly zero, because there's no benefit, only costs. But that's a side remark. Okay, so let's take a derivative of these guys with respect to, say, A1. Right? So where is A1? A1 is all over the place. Wherever I see A1, I underline it with 1 score with one line. I just underscore it. I underscore it once. So where do you see A1? Do you see A1 when small t is equal to 1? No, because it's just 0. Do you see A1 when small t equals 2? 2? Yes, there it is. And it comes with the coefficient beta times this thing. Okay? When small t equals to 3, where is A1? A1 is here. And it comes with coefficient beta squared times h epsilon divided by h0 plus 2 h epsilon, right? When small t equals to big T, where is a1? It's here. So for every t bigger than 1, you have a1 somewhere in the formula once with exponentially changing coefficients, okay? So when you take the derivative of this function with respect to A1, you will get the expression precisely as it is in your slides. Yeah? Now, where is A2? Suppose we want to take a derivative with respect to A2. Now, small t equals 1, there's no A2. Small t equals 2, is there an A2? No, there is none. No, there's not. Small t equals 3, is there A2? Yes, there is. Here it is. Is there an A2 when small t equals 4? Yes, When small t equals 5, in fact, there is an a2 everywhere as long as small t is larger than 2. Okay. So, and when we take the derivative of this expression with respect to a2, we will have the expression that you see in front of your eyes in your slides. Take the derivative with respect to a3. I hope by now you get the pattern. Yeah. So this is how you get this is how you get the pattern. Now, to get back to Nico's question. How do you get this exponent in beta? Well, look here. These are your first order conditions, and if you look at your first order conditions, you'll see that the exponent of the first term always increases. It used to be 1 for a1, it's now 2 for a2, 3 for a3, big T minus 1 for a big T minus 1. Okay. So, but then, when you take the derivative, don't forget the costs of effort, right? Don't forget this term. When you take the derivative of the costs of effort with respect to t, the coefficient on the marginal cost of effort is beta t minus 1. Okay? So that gives you these coefficients. And the exponent on the beta, coefficient in front of the marginal cost term is one unit less than the exponent on this beta. So we can divide these first order conditions through by the lowest exponent of the beta, and when we divide it by the lowest exponent on the beta, we will always have beta, beta squared, beta third, beta, etc. Okay? So that's what it's doing here. Whatever your t is, it will start with the coefficient beta. So that's where this exponent comes from. Nico, Daniel, does it make sense to you? No, I don't see it. Either I don't understand your question or it's too simple. Yeah? Exactly.
This ratio thing, and as I divide it, it becomes this minus t. Right?
Yes, yes. Whatever small t is, you always start with beta to the power of 1. Mm-hmm. Whatever your t is, you always start with beta to the power of 1. In order to make sure that your progression starts with beta to the power of 1, you do this subtraction. So that you always have 1 in the beginning of the count. Yeah.
And why do we have to have this S?
Well, S is the counter. S starts with T, with respect to which you take the derivative, and ends at the end of the period. That's why you need the T. That's why you need the counter. It's not T, because T changes. Sorry. It's not T, because T is fixed. T is constant here. T is just 2, 3, for whatever period you take the derivative. But the first order condition for, let's take period 6. Let's take 6 years after the start of your tenure, right? The first order condition for your optimal effort 6 years into your tenure depends on what happened 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. That's why it's the sum. The first order condition for the optimal effort in the very beginning of your tenure. Oh, sorry, it's the other way around, of course. No, I'm wrong. Ignore it. Take t equals 6. What is important for your effort at t equals 6 is what happens in the next year, what happens in 2 years' time from now, and what happens in the final year of your working life. But what is not important is what happened 5 years ago, 4 years ago, or 3 years ago, right? When you calculate the optimal effort in the very beginning of your career, you have to understand the things that you do now in the beginning of your career will have an effect until the very end of your career. See?
the things that you do at the very end of your career will have an effect only for a few years that you still have left. That's why this sum shrinks as you move towards the end of your working life. And that's why the optimal effort decreases as you move towards the end of your working life. Okay, so I consider this question answered. Okay. So, then Daniel and Nico asked me a second question. Practice question four, how can we show the relation between beta star, sigma squared star, and marginal productivity graphically without having concrete functions? Well, if you read the text of practice of this practice question, it says assume a particular functions. So, for instance, assume that output is just a linear function of effort, so that P prime of E is just a constant, and assume quadratic costs for simplicity. And also assume the precision costs. So assume the some functional specification for that M as a function of sigma squared. Yeah, so take, for instance, I don't know, minus squared or exponential and play around with it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So these graphic illustrations of what's happening, of course, are subject to some assumptions, as the practice question mentions. So, okay, now let's move on. So the only remaining person who bothered to ask me questions about the course was Carolina. A very prominent voice in this group. She asked a number of questions, and but they were not very precise. So I'm looking forward to making it more concrete. Lecture one, practice question one. So this is a question about why the worker is better off above his indifference curve and the firm is better off below its indifference curve, as far as I remember, right?
Yes, but I guess I remember that the practice question 3 because I wrote down probability that FP is bigger than FA.
So you were asking, in fact, you were asking about practice question 3.
I guess so, yes.
Not practice question 1. Okay.
And because I was wondering if you could just write down 1 minus probability FA greater than FB.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be obvious, but is it really the solution? Because it should just give you counter probability.
Given the notations in the slides, what's the probability that FB is larger than FA? Yeah, it's 1 minus the probability that FB is smaller than FA, exactly. So it's 1 minus the result that you already have in the lecture slides. But you have to, simplify it bring it into the shape that you could say that you could look at and say something about the trade-off between employment contract and sales contract. So simply saying it's 1 minus the original probability will not give you a lot of points. Okay. So, next question. Lecture 2. How to add communications in the objective function? Lecture 2 was about, remind me, yes, it was about authority. It was about Aguillon and Tirol model.
How would pay be added in the function?
You don't need to add it in the function. You don't need to add it in the function. What communication does is it reduces or increases the effort of the principal.
Communication costly to the agent?
Not in this model.
Oh.
Not in this model. Communication in this model is costless. If it were costly, then it would be a different model, would be more complicated. But communication is costless. You know, it doesn't cost you anything to reveal information to the principal. The question is, will you do it or will you not do it? And your propensity to reveal, your propensity to inform the principal depends on whether it's integration or delegation, whether it's the P formal authority or the A formal authority. So the P formal authority, the integration, when the principal retains the formal authority to overrule the advice from the agent if the principal has the information to do so, under this, in this environment, this is the utility function of the agent, if you may remember. Now let us differentiate the utility function of the agent with respect to the intention of communication. We use the formula for the full differential. So we first have to differentiate it with respect to the principal's effort, and then we'll have to multiply it by the derivative of the principal's effort with respect to the communication, which is positive. The more you negative, I forgot. It doesn't really matter. It depends on how you specify communication, right? So let's say the principal's effort to investigate projects reduces if you communicate more to the principal. It doesn't really matter. So look at the expression. This is the expression. This is what happens to the utility of the agent under P formal authority, when the agent has the option to communicate some information to the principal. So the agent will only communicate when the marginal utility of the agent with respect to the communication intensity is positive. You will only do certain things if you benefit from it. Now, let's assume that after some reparameterization, this thing is positive. It's not very important. What is important is this. So this is the effort of the agent. This is the congruence parameter between the principal and the agent, right? Now, if the congruence is high, then the agent will be more likely to communicate information to the principal. If me and my principal are the best pals in the world, if we are always one, then beta is going to be very large. So I will keep communicating information to my best pal, my principal, even if I work extremely hard, because this difference between beta and agent's effort is still going to be positive. If, however, I hate the principal, if our preferences with regards to what is the best project in the world are very, very different, so the beta is very small, I will only communicate if the effort I choose to exert is small enough, and which may or may not be the case depending on the first order conditions under P formal authority. So under P formal authority, the answer is, we're not sure whether the agent will communicate to the principal or not. And it makes a lot of sense because, remember, in P formal authority, the principal can overrule the agent. So if I discover some information, if I'm the agent and Caroline is the principal and we are at loggerheads with each other, right? So I've discovered some information that, okay, this project is good, this project is bad, this project is good for the principal, this project is bad for me, etc. So if I reveal this information to Caroline, she will know. And I will invest effort into discovering what's best project for me. Then I will come with my recommendation. And what will Carolina do? She will use the information that I communicated to her in order to say, sorry, Nick, we will do something else. Anticipating this, I will be less likely to communicate anything to Carolina. Now, in order to make Nick reveal more information to the principal, I'm afraid she is going to have to delegate more things to me. Because if there is delegation, if we are under a formal authority, then the marginal utility of the agent with respect to the communication intensity is inequivocally, is unambiguously, is always positive. Right? Why is it always positive? Because the agent's effort is always strictly less than one. Okay. So under delegation, it doesn't matter how hard I work, I will always find it optimal to communicate to the principal. And this again also makes a lot of sense. Why does it make a lot of sense? Because under delegation, I basically can do whatever I can. However, if I fail to obtain information about which project is best for me, I will have to have recourse to the principal. I will have to call the principal and ask, look, Carolina, I screwed up. I really don't know what the best project is. Can you recommend one? Now, the more information I reveal to Carolina, the more likely she will be in a position to advise something. So I will choose to communicate a lot with Carolina when there's plenty of delegation as an insurance against the situation in which neither principal nor agent will have information about which is the best project, in which case everybody's payoff will be zero because we will not do a thing. Okay? So that's the story. You understand?
Yes.
Good. Let's move on. Lecture 3/4, performance measure, precision 1 over sigma squared by Howe in this expression. You probably wrote it very quickly, so can you please...
Because you wrote down on the slide N32 that the performance method measurement precision is this function that we had.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is only a function, so we should be able like to plug in the beta star, and then we only have the function of something. Can we like specify to get an explanation like 1 over sigma squared? Because, I mean,
the costs of measurement, this m of sigma squared thing, right? These costs do not have to depend on the strength of incentives. In fact, I don't see a single reason why they should depend on the strength of incentives. So m of sigma squared is just a function of sigma squared. Now, to get back to your question about precision. So precision is indeed measured with 1 over sigma squared, right? But 1 over sigma squared and sigma squared, there's a one-to-one correspondence between them. If I know 1 over x, I know x, right? So I can specify this precision cost function in terms of 1 over sigma squared if I want to. I can specify it in terms of sigma squared if I want to. I can specify it in terms of any one-to-one mapping of sigma squared into anything. So m of sigma squared is the cost of precision function in the sense that if you want to have higher precision, you want to have lower sigma squared. If you want to have lower sigma squared, you have to pay more money to measure things more precisely. If you don't have enough money to measure things very precisely, you can settle for the next best option, which will give you a higher sigma squared at a lower cost. So the cost of the precision of information measurement is a function, is a decreasing function of sigma squared. So higher sigma squared means lower precision, means lower measuring costs. For example, let's think, okay. So, for example, suppose the cost of measurement is, 5 divided by sigma squared. So your m of sigma squared is 5 divided by sigma squared. If you want to have super high precision, sigma squared equals 0, it's unattainable because then the costs of measuring, the measurement costs will be infinite. If you want to have a totally crap measure of performance, which is totally uninformative, so sigma squared is 0, you don't have to pay anything. You just ask me and I will tell you some garble. I will tell you some gibberish and you will use this as a totally useless information, right? So m of sigma squared can be also rewritten as m of 1 of over sigma squared. It really doesn't matter. The derivative will change, but other than this, nothing. So next question. Next question, practice question 3 on slide 40. What the hell is practice question 3 on slide 40?
In the risk-sharing question with RA and bigger RB equals 0, how much should E pay to A so that A would be willing to guy with more and who is more risk averse should get a fixed wage. But
that's
I
right.
don't know how much. I mean,
the fixed wage.
And to how much fixed?
Yeah. The fixed wage is going to be equal to the certainty equivalent that A would have from his income if he was alone. And what is the certainty equivalent? Certainty equivalent is expected income minus this half of the variance times risk aversion, right? So suppose your income in expectation is 100 euros. Just as a numerical example, suppose your income in expectation is 100 euros. The variance of this income is, let's say, 10 euros, and your risk aversion coefficient is, let's say, 1. So you're risk averse. So your expected income is 100, your variance of income is 10, and your risk aversion is 1. Okay, what is your certainty equivalent? Your certainty equivalent is 100 minus half times 1 times 10, right? So it's going to be how much? It's going to be 95, okay? So you have an income which is 100 in expectation, but you're willing to trade it for a sure wage of 95 euros. Now, suppose you meet up with someone who is risk neutral, who doesn't care about risks. All he cares about is expectation. He can buy you for the price of 95 euros in exchange for the expected income of 100 euros. Is this a profitable deal? It's a very profitable deal because as far as somebody risk neutral is concerned, he's getting 5 euros. And the risk averse agent is equally well off, whether he's on his own or in partnership. Yeah. Will this partnership be profitable? It'll be hugely profitable. The banks want your deposit money. They don't want deposit money from other banks. Why? Because you, as a member of public, is risk averse, and you would settle for an interest rate of next to zero, which is what most banks are paying right now. If you're a hedge fund, you wouldn't care about depositing your money, with a silly bank, because you could, you know, you're risk neutral or even risk loving, depositing your money. But you get the point. You get the point. So yes, the answer is this is how much the agent would get as a fixed wage, and the other agent who is risk neutral would get a 5 euros in expectation more than the income that he would otherwise have enjoyed. Okay, so next lecture 7, practice questions 2 and 3. It's about recognition, right? I think we've gone through them already. Yeah, so lecture 7 we've gone through already, right? Yeah. Okay. So now the last question you had was lecture 8, slide 25, unstable equilibrium. What is the case? The stability of equilibrium?
No, it's not stable, I thought.
It's not stable. Let's think about it. I haven't had time to look into this particular question, so I'm thinking on my feet now. I see the intuition. The intuition is the following. So let's think about two focal Nash equilibria. In fact, there are two Nash equilibria. So one Nash equilibrium is when everybody is putting in Pareto efficient effort. And the other equilibrium is when everybody is putting in the effort level 0 or 1 over n or whatever, right? So there is a good equilibrium and a bad equilibrium. Is good equilibrium a stable equilibrium? Now, so how do we define stability? We define stability in this epsilon sigma language of stability, right? So if one player's action deviates from the equilibrium by a small epsilon, if you're putting in a little bit less effort, just a tiny little bit less effort than Pareto efficient, right? The total output is not going to reach the target and everybody is going to get no bonus, right? Everybody is going to get a pay of zero. So your withdrawing effort is going to cost everybody their share, okay, in the bonus. If people anticipate this, they will further withdraw their effort. So yes, in this sense, this equilibrium is unstable because it takes one person deviating, and then once you deviate from the equilibrium, you will gravitate towards the zero effort equilibrium. Because once you deviate even by a little bit, you will not get your bonus. So yes, it is unstable equilibrium. Yeah. So, but what is the question? It's a Nash equilibrium according to the definition of Nash equilibrium.
So, because it's the best response to the other persons.
It's the best you can do, assuming everybody else does it.
Okay, and that's why it's unstable, because...
No. It's different things. You can have a Nash equilibrium, which has one definition, which is what you've just said. And Nash equilibrium can be stable, it can be unstable. The stability and equilibrium are two different things.
So I think the one with the zero would be a
stable. Would be stable, yes. Why? Well, let's use the same logic. Suppose you are in the zero effort equilibrium, right? And suppose that through some trembling hand or through some accident or whatever, you moved your finger and so your effort level is now epsilon above zero, right? Will you get any benefit from this effort? No, because you're still miles below the target. So you will withdraw your effort back to zero, and so will the other guys do. So it is stable in the sense that once you deviate from it, you will get back to it. Now, the Pareto efficient equilibrium is unstable in the sense that once you deviate from it, you will not get back to it. You will degrade into the zero effort equilibrium. Well, if you have an advanced degree in mathematics, you may, right? So, I'm not trying to ridicule your point. I think it's a very deep point, and this point is not about whether it's an equilibrium or not. This point is about how sustainable this equilibrium is. So, stability and equilibrium are two different things. You can have equilibria which are unstable, which is this budget-breaking Pareto-efficient equilibrium, and you have equilibria that are stable, which is a zero-effort equilibrium. So,
well, I do think that sometimes we do this calculation, but if I work on a team, and then we have to do a poster or something, then I'm thinking, well, should I do something for the poster, yes or no? What do the other people do? They would do something, okay, I'm doing something, then we're in equilibrium number one. Or I think, well, other people are not going to
equilibrium too. Yeah. Yeah.
So I do think that it's practical to do these calculations in your free time.
Well, you can equally. I don't really have anything particularly deep to, you know, either support or challenge this view, because we're talking about rather abstract things. I mean, suppose that the bonus is really huge and the costs of effort are really small, right? So suppose that once you move a finger, you will already get the bonus, right? So doing the same calculations as the ones you described now would suggest that everybody will put this effort and everybody will get the bonus, and so this would suggest that this equilibrium is somehow sustainable and stable, but it's not. It's not stable. It's still not stable. Because if one deviates, if just one bastard deviates from this equilibrium, your bonus is gone. No matter how cheap or expensive it is to achieve it. See?
Yes.
So stability is something different. It's something a little bit more mathematical than the nice example you tried to give. That's it. That's not it. The last thing I wanted to go through with you is this tutorial exercise, which Henrique told me you didn't have time to solve. No, there are no multiple choice questions. There are questions that ask you to give a definition or explain the notions of things. So just, you know, cheap questions, 5 points or so. There are questions that ask you to do some derivations and prove some things and establish some results. There are questions that ask you to comment on the, you know, your previous results. So it's this kind of thing. Definitional questions and some more serious questions. Yesterday I wrote the version 1 of the exam and version 2 of the exam, so the version 1 of the exam you'll have on Saturday or Friday. Friday, so I wish you best of luck, whoever signed up for it. Those who didn't sign up for it will have the opportunity to challenge themselves to a test later on in the semester. It's pretty much the same, pretty much the same thing as the Personnel Economics 1 exam. Definitions, derivations. Yeah. Okay, so Henrique just asked me to go through with you the following question. Oh, I can, you know what I can do? I can just open my Dropbox and do it. Because I have the solutions. So here's the exercise, which asks you to recall one result from the leadership lecture, and this result is this. So how much are you better off knowing the true state of the world as compared to not knowing the true state of the world? So what are the gains in terms of expected payoffs from knowing the true state of the world, right? So if you don't know, let's start with the following. If you don't know the true state of the world, you use your best guess about the true state, about the state of the world. You do need to have some idea about the state of the world. You do need to know whether it's hot or cold outside in order to decide what to wear. Now, if you don't know exactly the temperature outside, you will recall all the summers or winters in your life and calculate the average temperature and say, okay, given this average temperature, I should wear a coat. Or if you're risk averse, I will wear 2 coats just in case. Right, but you will still use the average. Now, what will be your expected output? What will be your expected output when you decide, when you take your action based on the average state of the world? In the formula, it is theta, the true state of the world, divided by n, by the size of your team, times the total output that team members independently create. Now, we know that the Nash equilibrium level of effort in this public goods game is theta divided by n. So if no one knows the true state of the world, everybody will put in the effort equal to theta bar divided by n. The total effort will therefore be theta bar, and you will get 1/n share of it. And then don't forget that whatever you produce is multiplied by the coefficient theta, which measures the state of the world. So this is your expected payoff if you don't know the state of the world. And what this term is doing here, this term is the costs of effort. So your costs of effort are your effort squared divided by 2. if your effort square is theta bar divided by n, it's theta bar squared divided by n squared and then divided by 2. So this is your expected out, this is your expected payoff. This is this thing. This is your expected payoff if you don't know the state of the world. Now, if you do, if everybody does know the state of the world, then you don't wear a coat because it's generally cold in the winter. You wear a thick coat or a lighter coat depending on the actual temperature on the street. What is your payoff if you know the true state of the world? If you know the true state of the world, this is your payoff by the same logic as here. Now, let us take the expectation of this expression and the claim in the lecture, which is what we're going to derive today, what we're going to derive right now. The claim is that this expression is equal to variance of the states of the world times some function of the team size. Okay? Have you tried it at home? You tried it at home? No. Okay. Well, I have the derivations. I don't mind sharing them with you just at this special occasion. So, basically, that's it. Complete the square. In English, it's called complete the square formula. You know what I'm talking about? Completing the square? You know this a minus b squared is a squared minus 2ab plus b squared? If you have some function of a squared and b squared and some function of ab, you can transform it into the a minus b squared if you complete, if you add or subtract the terms. So this is the first thing I do. I just bring everything to the common denominator. And then I take this common denominator, which is non-stochastic, out of the expectation sign. It's just a number, okay? So I have to deal with this business. And it looks ugly, but in fact, it's not very ugly. It's actually, you know, quite easy to deal with because you can take this guy and you can rewrite it by completing the square, by completing the squares, and after rearranging terms, you can rewrite it as this formula. Verify this independently if you don't believe me. Now, this is the full square, right? Yeah? This is the full square. And this is an easy term to deal with. So you have 2n minus 1 times this full square plus twice n minus 1 times this expression. And then the business is to take the expectation of this term and then take the expectation of this term and see what happens. Now, what is the expected value of theta minus theta bar squared? What is it by definition? What happens when you take the expected value of the square of the deviations between the values of a random variable and its average? What is it by definition? It's the variance, exactly. So if you open Wikipedia, Wikipedia will tell you variance is the expected value of the square of the deviation from the mean. Right? So this thing is just 2 times n minus 1 times the variance of theta. Now, what is this guy? Well, 2 times n minus 1 is non-stochastic, is a number which can be taken outside the expectation sign. Theta squared bar, is this stochastic or is it a number? Is it a number or is it stochastic? No, it's a number. Theta bar, average. The average temperature in the winter is minus 20 degrees Celsius. The sample average is stochastic. But theta bar is population average. So theta bar is a number. All right? So theta bar is the number. And so is theta, well, theta bar squared is the number, and so is theta bar. So you can take theta bar outside of the expectation term. You can take theta bar outside the expectation term. So very quickly, you will end up with the expected value of theta. What is the expected value of theta? It's theta bar. So when you take the expectation of this product, you will have theta bar times theta bar, which is theta bar squared. So theta bar squared minus theta bar squared is obviously zero. So this term in the expectation is zero. This term in the expectation is the variance. Then don't forget this 1 over 2n squared term. And when you put everything together, you will arrive at you will arrive at this result. What does this result mean? I mean, it's a simple piece of algebra, not very inspiring, right? But what does it mean for economists? Why do we need to, you know, why do we take interest in it? Shall I bring it back so that you can copy? Okay, no problem, no problem. Okay. Looks like a modern art gallery. But, right. Are you through? Are you through? Shall I, can I move on? Okay. So, what does this thing tell us? What does it mean? Well, it tells us, forget this end thing, because this is entirely due to the team structure. It's sort of mildly interesting, but not very interesting. The most interesting is this term, the variance. What it tells us? It tells us that the value of information about the true state of the world is proportional to the degree of uncertainty about this true state of the world. If we know that things are certain, the value of information is zero. So, in the Catholic Church, the priests have to be men, okay? Suppose I'm interested in the gender of a Catholic priest, or for that matter, Orthodox Church, to which I belong. The priests have to be men. Suppose I'm interested in the gender of this particular priest, and somebody is telling me, Nick, I can tell you the gender of this particular priest. Will I be interested in this information? No, because I know that priests are by definition men in this religion, okay? So the variance of the priest's gender is going to be zero, and therefore the value of knowing the gender of the priest is zero to me because I knew it already, okay? Now, if on the other hand, I am I am an investor in a very buoyant, promising, but very uncertain market. Suppose I want to invest in Africa, right? There are some very valuable investment opportunities there, but there are some very disastrous investment projects in Africa. You know, you can become a millionaire by discovering some diamonds in Congo, or you can get killed in the attempt of having your diamonds stolen from you, right? So the uncertainty about the true state of the world is extremely high. And therefore, the value of information about where the diamonds are and where the pirates are in this area is very, very valuable because it's a matter of many, many millions of dollars or even life and death. Do you understand the intuition, right? So this is a way to sort of gauge the importance of information about the true state of the world. The importance of this information is proportional one-to-one to the degree of uncertainty of the state of the world. Why do you need the leader? The leader is the provider of information about the true state of the world. This leader is a cheeky guy because he's self-serving. He's partly benefiting from your effort and therefore he's trying to inspire you to work hard, whatever the state of the world is. This is the leader's credibility problem that we discussed last week. Yeah? But so when the state of the world is very certain, there is not really a lot of variation there, you don't need a leader. You don't care about this funny person because whatever he says, you're going to do your own thing because you know what the state of the world is. If, however, the state of the world is uncertain, if there is a crisis after crisis, everybody's saying, we need to show some leadership. What does it mean? We need someone to come up and to say, guys, we need to do this. In a situation which is very non-trivial as far as the right course of action is concerned. It is precisely in these situations the uncertainty of output is very high and leaders are most needed. So that's my little story along the lines of a very simple algebraic derivation. So, okay, I've answered the questions that people have sent to me in preparation to this lecture. I've done some tutorial questions that you didn't have time to cover. I see that everybody's dying to leave, and so am I. So thanks for coming here, and good luck with your exams.